From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1983 when a young computer hacker thought he was playing a game. His name was David Lightman, and he found this computer game to be intense, a lot of fun, a kind of nuclear weaponry simulation. But it turned out that what Lightman thought was a game was not a game at all. He had accessed a United States military supercomputer tied to the nuclear weapons control system. Lightman accidentally set that computer system on a course to launch World War III. Here's the good news, that story was fiction. It's the plot of the 1983 blockbuster film War Games, starring Matthew Broderick. But here's the interesting part. RIT professor Josephine Wolfe recently wrote for Slate magazine online that, quote, "Legend has it that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was born of the movie War Games. The true moral of that movie is that you shouldn't use your children's names as passwords, but Congress drew a different lesson from it and began drafting a broad piece of legislation against computer crimes," end quote. Wolf concludes her piece with a kind of grim point about the challenge in regulating new technologies, because some of the activities that we want to encourage among the non-criminals, the good guys, are basically the same as the activities that we want to stop when criminals want to perform them. Well, this coming Sunday, the Ewing Forum at Finger Lakes Community College is hosting a discussion under the heading Cybersecurity and Privacy in the Age of Terrorism. You don't need me to tell you that cybersecurity has been a significant story in recent months, with allegations of Russian hacking, among other things, so we have a lot to discuss this hour. In studio with me is Josephine Wolfe, who's an assistant professor of public policy at RIT and faculty affiliate of RIT's Department of Computing Security. Josephine, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And on the line with us is the headline speaker of that Ewing Forum event. It's Stuart Baker. He's a partner in Steptoe and Johnson LLP, former First Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and former General Counsel of the National Security Agency. Stuart, thank you for taking the time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Josephine, I just have to get this out of the way here, because I haven't seen War Games in years. I probably saw it as a kid growing up. There really was sort of a, it caused a little bit of a stir in 1983, huh?
They showed a clip at one of the first congressional hearings when they reconvened that fall. It really made quite an impression.
And your piece there was a lesson to me that some of the framework for what we're doing today does go back several decades, and that kind of made my head spin a little. I think, you know, how can you be working off of 1980s legislation when so much has changed?
Well, I think it's important to remember how long it takes to pass new legislation and the fact that laws that we pass are intended to last for a long time, right? We don't pass a law and expect to be changing it 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road. So it was written in the 80s, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, with the intention that it would last a long time. The language in it is deliberately vague in some ways, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want laws to last a long time. But it's also true that it's very hard to predict, sitting there in the 80s, what we're going to be using for computers for years later.
And Hollywood had it right. Don't use the word password as your password. Don't use your kids' names. I mean, you'd think by now we'd have gotten this figured out. If you go back to 1983, maybe that was still sort of new, that kids' names. That was a good lesson.
It was a good lesson. We're still learning it. It's taken longer than we might have thought.
John Podesta has some things to learn, I think. Stuart Baker, let me turn to you and just ask you, before we kind of dive into the discussion, the broad outline of what you're talking about on Sunday at FLCC is cybersecurity and privacy in the age of terrorism. And listeners, that event, all the Ewing Forum events are so popular and so interesting. That's on Sunday at 4 p.m. at FLCC's Student Center Auditorium. I have no idea if there are still tickets available. You should jump online and try to find out. But Stuart, what do you want to make sure that you leave the audience with on Sunday?
I want them to understand that this, which is not difficult, one, that this is a serious problem, and you know, the fact that we discovered that it was a serious problem in the 1980s and still haven't addressed it suggests that we've been going down the wrong path as we try to fix it, and no matter what we do on passwords, the whole password system is fatally flawed. So we really do need a new approach. And I'll talk a little bit about why I think some of the privacy groups have actually made us less safe, because they've fought most of the cybersecurity measures that we've tried to put in place since the 1980s. And actually, they're trying to seriously do harm to the 1980s legislation as well, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not so good reasons. So I'll try to lay out the complexity of the issue and give people some idea of things that we'll probably see from the Trump administration if they decide they're really going to tackle this issue head on.
Listeners, if you have any questions on cybersecurity, privacy, and related issues this hour, this is a great chance to have those questions answered. You can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'd like to ask both of you a question that I'm sure is on the minds of the audience. And, you know, you're probably both tired of talking about it. But, Stuart, I'll start with you. What do we actually know versus what we think we know versus what is pure speculation in regards to alleged Russian hacking? What actually happened that we can say for sure?
I think we can say, based on the evidence that I've seen, that the Russians hacked the DNC and John Podesta. The evidence is pretty strong that it was the military intelligence unit of the Russian government that did those hacks. What's a little less clear is that it was the Russians who then leaked it to WikiLeaks, although I think the evidence there is pretty evocative. And if you ask me, I'm pretty confident they did it, but I think the evidence is not quite as good.
Okay. Josephine, how would you answer? Same question. What do we know?
I think that's exactly right. We have pretty clear evidence that Russia was behind a number of those breaches that came out during the election, and we have the intelligence community's word that they're pretty confident that Russia was also behind leaking to WikiLeaks. And depending on how much you trust the intelligence community, and I tend to take them at their word, then you either think that's sort of sufficient evidence or you're more skeptical.
Okay. Now,
the one thing I would jump in to stress that is probably the weakest of this is whether it was done to help Donald Trump. There's a long history, and we get this from the intelligence community, of Vladimir Putin taking really personally something that happened in December of 2011, which we've all forgotten, which was when he was up for election, and there were massive crowds in the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg protesting his effort to fix the election. And the U.S. government encouraged that and lent tools for communication to the people who were organizing those protests. And Putin has never forgotten that, and he's never forgiven Clinton for what he saw as an interference in domestic affairs in Russia. And if you look back at what Russia did, as soon as there was somebody in the streets in the United States, which was in 2012 when Occupy Wall Street was at its height, all of Russian propaganda was aimed at giving a megaphone to Occupy Wall Street, not because it was of its left-wing politics, and probably later not because of Trump's right-wing politics, but because it was going to embarrass Clinton and the Obama administration. And I think that's how they got started with this. At the end, they may have said, hey, there's a bonus here. Trump may be much more friendly to us. But I suspect that this was mostly about teaching a lesson to Hillary Clinton.
Okay. And Stuart, when it comes to how common this is, I think it's important to add context to the extent that we can and ask, is this the kind of thing, meddling in an election, hacking information, maybe, you know, causing a little bit of disruption, is this the kind of thing that they have done before in previous elections here and in other countries, or is this more of an outlier?
This is an outlier to some extent, but they have been working up to this for quite a while, seeing what they can get away with. The hacking, first, they watched the Chinese hack everybody in ways that were obviously the Chinese government and pay a very small price for it. And so I think the Russians, who had been very stealthy, decided maybe there wasn't as much reason to be stealthy. And then they started using, they have a whole set of Twitter trolls who generate fake news inside Russia. And they actually ran an op that got very little attention in, I think, Louisiana, where they sent out a bunch of fake messages suggesting there'd been a massive explosion at a gas processing plant. designed to see whether they could create a panic inside the United States. Didn't work to create panic, but no one called them on it. They paid no price. So I think they have gotten more and more comfortable with the idea that they can interfere in our domestic affairs, they can run operations inside the United States against Americans, and up to now, not much bad has happened to him.
Okay, and Josephine Wolf, is there anything that you think the media has overstated when it comes to what the Russians did or did not do, in other words?
I think probably, from my perspective, the biggest overstatement might be that they actually swung the election. I don't think we have any clear evidence. I don't even know what evidence would look like to say that the documents that were released that they managed to compromise were the deciding factor. And like Stuart, I would say, I think that it's possible that the affection for Trump from the Russian government may be somewhat overstated as well, that this may have been less of a sort of deliberate planned attempt to make him president than it was a more kind of general effort to wreak havoc and humiliation.
Okay, so then the next question becomes, if Russia, as you say, Stuart, had been building up to this and sort of checking out what they could get away with and was probably pretty satisfied with itself, with the results of, with what it was able to do in the last several months here, what do we do about it? What do you think is being done? What do you think should be done, Stuart?
So we should not let this go unanswered. There are obviously things we ought to do to improve our security, and that means spending more money and maybe giving more control over security to the government and more regulatory authority. But we also need to do something that deters these attacks, because we'll never get our defenses to the point where they're completely effective. The Obama administration started that down that road, expelling a bunch of diplomats, closing some facilities used by the Russians, announcing relatively ineffective sanctions on intelligence agencies. To my mind, we probably need to do more to hurt Putin where he lives, which means probably actually releasing information that will hurt him politically. There's a lot of rumors that he's had several Botox treatments. I'd like to actually know that and see the pictures, too.
Let me ask Josephine, who you think ends up looking worst out of this? And I'm not talking about just because we were able to read the emails. I mean, engineer Rob Braden, if I were able to read all of your private emails about me, it probably wouldn't be all very kind, and I get it. It's like Rob saying zero. Okay, fine. I don't think it's fair to judge people on private emails. What I mean by who looks worst out of this is you had Donald Trump recently say, when the media tried to sort of pin him down on, do you at least acknowledge that Russia was involved in some way, he was kind of blaming the DNC, saying, well, look how they left it wide open, kind of pointing the finger at them for, being victimized because they were exposed. Who looks worst to this in this episode to you?
Well, I guess the Russians look worse to me, but I'm
because they actually did that.
I think, the DNC doesn't coming off looking great. I won't deny that. I think it's probably fair to say that most organizations going up against the Russian government would not win, and they were a little bit unskilled, but also a lot unlucky in who their adversary was and what their situation was. I don't think it's necessarily the case that the RNC or any other organization would have fared much better. I think Donald Trump, unwilling to take a strong stand on this or even acknowledge or accept the intelligence community's report on who was responsible for this, doesn't look good. I think he looks like he's willing to be very soft on this kind of adversary and this kind of attack. And I think President Obama looks a little bit weak as well. I think that the things that he did in response also are somewhat slap on the wrist rather than something that seems like it's actually going to have a huge
impact. For example, for people who missed it?
For example, evicting some of the Russian diplomats from the United States or telling them they can't use certain properties or places where they apparently like to congregate in the United States. I don't think that there are likely to be anyone in the Russian government or in other governments who are going to look at that and think seriously about whether or not they really want to engage in something of this nature in the future.
Stuart, do you agree with Josephine that Donald Trump doesn't look great with some of his equivocating and, frankly, some of his attacks on the intelligence community? I mean, he had that sort of bizarre speech to the CIA where he had CBS News says he packed around 40 friendly staffers to cheer for him, and he spent roughly half his time with the CIA talking about crowd size at the inauguration. Strange, but do you think he has looked bad in the way he has discussed national intelligence, the intelligence community, and can he put this behind him now?
So he's clearly of two minds about this. He wants to be very supportive of the men and women of the intelligence community. But he also suspected that somebody, probably at the top of one of the intelligence agencies, leaked the fact of this dossier and made it respectable for mainstream media to cover it. But you know, he would not be the first or the last president to complain about leaks from the intelligence community. So he's joined a long tradition just a little earlier than most. I do think he was mistaken to mock the DNC over their security, because there, but for the grace of God, goes the Trump campaign. If the Russians want to get you, it's what's important to remember, that if the Russians are after you, they'll send their C team after you, and if the C team compromises you, great. And if they can't, they send the B team. And if the B team can't compromise you, they'll send the A team. It looks to me as though Podesta got sort of a B team attack. But if he had not fallen prey to that, they would have found something else. When I got out of the government, one of the first things that the Chinese PLA did is they opened an email account for me at Yahoo with my name, and then sent emails with poisoned attachments to all the people who worked with me at my law firm. Now, it's really hard to persuade people not to open attachments labeled Homeland Security Report that seemed to come from me. So they would have found a way to get him, and they will find a way to get the people around Trump as well.
Hmm. Talking to Stuart Baker, who is a partner in Steptoe & Johnson LLP. He's the former First Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and former General Counsel of the National Security Agency. And Josephine Wolf in studio with me. She's an Assistant Professor of Public Policy at RIT and faculty affiliate of RIT's Department of Computing Security. And you can read some of her work, as I have, on Slate online. Great stuff there. And Stuart is coming on this coming Sunday to Canandaigua to FLCC's Student Center Auditorium. It's part of the Ewing Forum. And his event is titled Cybersecurity and Privacy in the Age of Terrorism. Tickets are $25. You can order them right now at gmeforum.org. And those events are always very popular. So that is this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. at FLCC. You want to call the program with questions or comments? You can do that. 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Stuart, you said earlier this hour, let's explore this a little bit more, and I wonder if Josephine agrees or disagrees. You said that you think there's an argument to be made that privacy groups are making us less safe. How?
So many of the things that the government has done, for example, the government has a program called Einstein, which is designed to inspect all incoming packets to the government and look for malware using signatures, and then if it finds malware that it knows about, prevent it from being delivered to the individuals that it's been sent to. Something that industry has been doing since 2000 or earlier. And the government has been proposing that this be done since the 2000s. Over bitter resistance from privacy groups that said, oh, so you're going to be spying on people who are communicating with the government, as though the government couldn't protect itself from malware, or as though the government needed to spy on email that was sent to the government. But that campaign actually slowed down the funding of the Einstein program by almost 10 years. Information sharing is another activity that is important. If you want to be able to identify malware signatures, you need the first person who gets that malware and spots it to share that information with lots of other people. And there was a law that was designed to ensure that U.S. government agencies could participate in those information sharing forums. And again, privacy groups fought it for years, say, because it would have overridden some requirements that the government not get information without a subpoena, essentially saying we don't want the U.S. government ever to have this data. We want all kinds of new privacy restrictions put on it. So there's really never been a cybersecurity measure that Congress has taken up that privacy groups haven't found some fault with, and I think that's irresponsible.
Okay. Josephine, agree or disagree?
I think I'm going to disagree, perhaps not endorsing all privacy groups ever, because I'm sure there are ones out there who have views that are more extreme than mine on this front, but I think groups like the EFF, the ACLU, the Center for Democracy and Technology have done really important and valuable work when it comes to looking at, for example, one of the examples Stuart gave, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, where the government was trying to make it easier for companies to share threat information, threat indicators with the government and vice versa. And absolutely, that's a piece of legislation that has a really valuable role to play in making sure people can respond to threats. But what a lot of privacy activists and groups were talking about at the time was we want to make sure that while this is happening, it's not being used as an additional tool for surveillance. And I think they're right to be concerned that one of the things, not the only thing the U.S. government is interested in, is broadening its surveillance powers. So, for instance, when that law was being voted on, you had people in Congress submitting amendments saying we'd like to make sure that any unnecessary or irrelevant threat information that might be shared as part of this is being anonymized, either by the companies that are sharing it or by the Department of Homeland Security. And that amendment was struck down. Nobody was having that. There was another one that was trying to say, well, maybe these should be subject to a Freedom of Information Act request. Maybe just because there's information sharing happening, it shouldn't be completely secret. Nobody can ever hear about it. Again, that was not included in the bill. And I think when you see things like that happening, to my mind, what you're seeing is privacy groups not trying to say the government can never know anything about threats, companies should never be able to share this information. They're trying to say we'd like to see some reasonable restrictions in place so that when this happens, it doesn't become a tool for unlimited surveillance on everybody. And I'm with them on that. I think that it is important to have those arguments play out, to have somebody arguing on the side of more restricted surveillance powers and making that case.
Well, let me follow up with you, then we'll have Stuart respond, and then we'll start taking your phone calls. What's the risk to the citizen, then, without some of these protections?
The risk to the citizen without these privacy protections?
Yeah.
I think the risk to the citizen is seeing this surveillance creep that we've already started to see and worrying that it's not going to be used just to hunt down the really dangerous terrorists among us, but also for a variety of more personal or smaller issues related to what's happening in your email, what's happening in your online activity, that once that starts being spread around the government, not just counterterrorism, but law enforcement, other kinds of things, you could see it becoming a really dangerous and really far-reaching kind of surveillance power.
All right, Stuart Baker, what do you think?
Oh, I thinking about some of the things that the privacy groups proposed. First, I thought that in my experience with the privacy groups on the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act was that they had a series of demands, and if the demands were met, they would come up with new ones. They just were opposed. But, for example, anonymization of data, which sounds like a good idea until you realize that when you get a signature, you have to share it immediately, within 30 seconds, because somebody else is being attacked with that piece of malware right now. And if you have to stop and say, oh, wait a minute, I better ask my lawyers if I've sufficiently anonymized this, you're trading the speed of light for the speed of lawyers. And I don't think we can afford to do that to have really effective anti-malware systems. And that was typical of some of the things that the privacy groups wanted. They wanted what they wanted, even if it meant that it did serious damage to the cybersecurity goals of the program. I do agree with Josephine that More data is being collected on us than at any time in history, and we're right to be uneasy about that, but most of that data is being gathered and used by the private sector. The government is a piker in that regard, and frankly, if information is going to be gathered about me and my family and my neighbors, I'd really rather it was used to fight terrorism than to sell me, you know, belly fat remedies.
Josephine, anything you want to add there?
I think that's fair, but I would say that really depends on how much you trust your government. And I think right at this very moment, when there are a lot of people very uneasy about the new administration, it's a moment to really think seriously about the question of if all of this data is being collected. And I would contest a little bit. Certainly private industry does a lot of this data collection, but we know from, say, some of the Snowden slides on PRISM that the government also has pipes into a lot of these industry databases. And I think to feel comfortable with that, feel comfortable that the government's really using that only to fight terrorism, you have to really have a lot of faith in people at the top.
All right, so listeners, you want to weigh in here? Let me grab our first phone call of the hour. It's from Daniel in Rochester. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi, guys. This is a awesome conversation. It's super needed.
Thanks.
In today's environment. I'm kind of responding to an earlier question you guys had that you posed, Evan, is who looks worst in this? And it, to my estimation, the tech community in the United States looks worst. We built the internet in this country. We built the majority of the programs and the services that we're using today, and they are literally the same as they were when they were made. Email, you know, the RFC for it has barely changed in the decades since it was put out there. It's no wonder. I mean, it's no wonder all these hacks are happening. Second off, companies are being forced by our government to put back doors in their products. This makes us look bad to everyone in the entire world. This makes all of the products that come out of the United States seem safe, are unsafe, and it's just we just can't keep doing this. And okay. I'll take my answers off the air.
Daniel, thanks for the phone call. I'll start in studio with Josephine, then we'll go to Stuart. What do you think, Josephine?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it was largely Americans who designed the internet, and that when they did that, they were not thinking about security. And for the most part, they weren't thinking about security because there were a dozen people using the internet, and they were all academics, and there was nothing worth securing on the internet, and that we haven't seen the architecture shift very dramatically since then. I think there are a lot of good reasons for that. I think one of the reasons for that is that the internet turns out to be sort of very successful and very effective in the form it currently has. Ditto email. I would love to see email re-architected with a little bit more security, with more widespread use of, say, digital signatures on emails. But I'm not sure it's fair to say that's the tech industry's fault or even the tech community's fault. I think that turns out to be a factor of how hard it is to change a technology that's being used by millions or billions of people when they really like the way that it works right now.
I want to put a little more blame on the tech community in two respects. Not just that they gave us something that wasn't secure when it was started, because I think Josephine's right about the reasons why that was the case. But the response to cybersecurity flaws from the community of, you know, the technology community has been a little like Donald Trump's mocking of John Podesta. The focus is on what was the mistake. Somebody made a mistake in coding this product, and all we need to do is stop having idiots code, and we will be safe. And so for 40 years, there's been this emphasis on sending people back and fixing flaws in the code, and that's certainly important. But the idea that we would somehow eventually get to a point where our systems were secure if we just kept patching flaws, I think is a bias of the technology community that has turned out to be utterly wrong. It's been a real dead end for us in terms of security. We've gotten less secure, notwithstanding that we all get our systems patched all the time now by Microsoft and everybody else, and yet we still are vulnerable. And the other bias is a little more subtle, but I think that the people who design these systems tend to be pretty libertarian, tend to be suspicious of government, and are inclined to avoid things that would undermine anonymity on the internet and to protect people's ability to do things without identifying themselves. And that's probably been the worst outcome of the design that we've seen. That it's still hard. It's nowhere near as hard as it used to be, but it's still hard to actually find people who are committing the crimes and punish them. We need to do more of that, and the Silicon Valley bias against government and inclination to protect individuals with anonymity has made it harder to do that.
All right, I'm late for our early break of the hour. Let's get our break, and we'll come back. We'll take more of your phone calls and comments if you like. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, to speak with Stuart Baker, who is a former First Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and former General Counsel of the National Security Agency, and Josephine Wolf in studio with me here. She's an Assistant Professor of Public Policy at RIT. She's written a lot of really interesting stuff for Slate Online. You might have seen her byline there, and a faculty affiliate of RIT's Department of Computing Security. Stuart is coming to FLCC as part of the Ewing Forum this coming Sunday, the 29th at 4 p.m. Tickets are $25, and you can get them online right now at the Ewing Forum's website. That's gmeforum.org. We'll be right back. Coming up in our second hour, we preview a film called Gabe that's coming to the Little Theater tomorrow night. It's about Gabe Weil, who at the age of 15 was told his diagnosis was changing and his life expectancy had doubled overnight, but he still had to face choices every single day. Choices about life and death, choices that could kill him, but he wanted to live. And he said in that way, muscular dystrophy was kind of a gift. We'll talk about it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Daniel in Rochester called, and Daniel, you've forced my hand. That was such a smart phone call and question, and that prompted a part of discussion that, frankly, I've got to go to this part of the discussion now that I thought we could save it for another hour of discussion next week. But because what we're talking about is sort of flaws in the internet itself, what I want to do is I want to bring up a question that Walter Isaacson raised. He wrote a piece for Time about a month ago titled, "The Internet is Broken. Starting from scratch, here's how I'd fix it." And in that piece, he essentially poses this thought experiment. If we were starting in 2017 creating a brand new internet, how different would it be from the internet that we have now? And I want to read two parts of this piece and ask both of our guests to comment, because I think it piggybacks on what we've been talking about. Isaacson writes the following, quote, "There is a bug in the internet's original design that at first seemed like a feature, but has gradually and now rapidly been exploited by hackers and trolls and malevolent actors. Its packets are encoded with the address of their destination, but not of their authentic origin. With a circuit-switched network, you can track or trace back the origins of the information, but that's not true with the packet-switched design of the internet." And he kind of goes on, and then here is his prescription. He says, if we could start from scratch, here's what I think we would do. One, create a system that enables content producers to negotiate with aggregators and search engines to get a royalty whenever their content is used, like ASCAP has negotiated for public performances and radio airings of its members' works. Two, embed a simple digital wallet and currency for quick and easy payments for songs, blogs, articles, and whatever other digital content is for sale. Three, encode emails with an authenticated return or originating address. Four, enforce critical properties and security at the lowest levels of the system possible, such as in the hardware or in the programming language, instead of leaving it to programmers to incorporate security into every line of code they write. And five, build chips and machines that update the notion of an internet packet. For those who want, their packets could be encoded or tagged with metadata that describe what they contain and give the rules for how it can be used." That's Walter Isaacson. Stuart, what do you think?
Well, he's a very smart man who's obviously thought about this. I'll put aside his lobbying for more money for people who produce content for a living, because that's what he does.
I'm a fan of that argument, by the way.
and I do too. But yeah. I think that's self pleading. But I think more attribution, more responsibility at the initiation stage will make it easier for us to find people who and refuse to do business with or carry the packets of people whose activities are antisocial in some respect. It's something we probably should do. Actually, there are ways to retrofit this. I think DNSSEC ask Josephine will probably be able to tell us more about that. But I think that addresses the idea that you ought to know where it's coming from, not just where it's going. There are some valuable ideas there. I don't want to say they're going to solve all the problems, because the history of cybersecurity is that as soon as we think we've solved the problem, the bad guys think of a way around it, and that may well happen here too. But it would be better, we'd get a better class of attacker, that's for sure.
All right, Josephine, what do you make of Walter's prescription there?
Well, he's not the first person to think about what if we did a clean slate redesign of the internet. In fact, I think there was a DARPA, the Defense Department Advanced Research Projects, couple grants that went to different academic groups to try and say, what would you do if you did it all over again? I have to say my personal bias is that is not going to happen, at least in the near future, that the idea that we're going to start over re-architecting
the internet. So it's sort of a waste of time as a thought experiment?
I don't think it's a waste of time. I think it's a valuable academic exercise. I'm not sure that I think it's the most productive way to try and improve our security day to day. I think in terms of the actual concrete things that he suggests, there's a lot of value in trying to think about what happened when we went to packet switch networks, which is what he's talking about. What happens when we start chopping data up into little packets and sending them over networks, as opposed to the circuit networks, the telephone networks he talks about, where you have a full connection between two people, between two points, and you know where everything starts and where everything ends. I think to brush aside the benefits of the packet switch network, which has allowed for a whole range of different technologies we could never have had on the telephone network, is a big mistake. But setting that aside, I think embedding more attribution sounds good. To me, it's a very, very tricky question how you do that in a real way. Because when we're talking about attribution on a network, usually what we're talking about is, can you tie a packet to, let's say, at best, the device it originated from? Can I prove this packet started on your phone? More likely, it's going to be, can I tie it to the internet connection point, right? The wireless network in this room, perhaps, that you're connected to, where it originated. And those are all going to be things that other people can use, right? Just because a message is sent from your phone doesn't mean that you sent it. I could have sent it. Somebody who's compromised your phone remotely could have sent it. Certainly, if we're just talking about a connection point, then somebody who's in this building could be using the wireless. Somebody, again, could have compromised it remotely. And the more confident we are that our attribution capabilities are really flawless on the internet, I think the more dangerous it becomes, because absolutely, as Stuart says, there are going to be people who find ways to compromise the different types of technologies we come up with to prove that everything that was sent from this device or this address was really you. And what you really want to do in the legal sense is drill it down to a person. Right, we can't put your iPhone in jail. We want to say who actually did this, and that's just not something you can do in a network technology.
Yeah, if I could jump in, we're not always trying to criminally convict someone based on the attribution of some packets. It might simply be this machine has been sending a lot of spam. We're not going to take any mail from it anymore until you demonstrate that you've fixed whatever problem it was. That doesn't require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It just requires people who are sensitive to spam to say, I think I can live without this person's communications until they've had a chance to demonstrate they've done something about the spam that's coming from their machine. And it would be useful to be able to track the spam back to individual machines.
But that's something we already do. We have lots of machines and institutions that are blacklisted, even if only temporarily, when there's a huge influx in spam and taken offline or not allowed to send emails until they've managed to take care of that problem.
Yes, and I think the point is we do that. We could do it better if we had finer tuned attribution, and it wouldn't be the end of the world, even for some innocent whose machine has been taken over by a spammer to suddenly discover that they have a problem. They're not going to jail, but they do need to do something about their machine.
I think the technology for that is really pretty much already in place. If you get the internet service providers to be interested, to be willing to do that sort of thing, they can already pretty clearly identify here are machines that are compromised.
And they don't. And they don't because if they took you offline because of some problem with your machine, you would pick up the phone and call them and spend half an hour on the phone with them trying to figure out what was wrong, and that's a very expensive phone call. So the ISPs just don't want the cost because it's not their problem.
Right, but my point is it's not a question of re-architecting the internet or the technology. It's a question of changing the incentives for the different actors involved.
We have to do that, too. I agree.
Okay, well, let me read a couple of emails from listeners who were hoping our panelists would address them. Dave writes to the program, Dave must be having a dark day, but here it is. He says, whether the Russians meant to disrupt our election or not, I think it is safe to say, due to the nature of our electorate, they have established an effective template to fomenting distrust in our election process. I don't think this will be an easy problem to solve in a democracy like ours, as so many citizens already doubt the credibility of our political system. And he goes on to say, this is one reason why so many left-leaning Bernie supporters have taken to supporting a more socialistic order in America, and couple that with the current right-wing fervor, and you have a tinderbox ready to disrupt in every election. So Dave is feeling like at least they have fomented real distrust going forward, Stuart. Do you agree with that?
I think they've built on an existing mistrust, but very effectively, somewhat to my aggravation, the buses in D.C. for a while were completely wrapped with messages from the network that used to be called Russia Today, RT. And the message on it was always get a second opinion, with the notion that their opinion would be the second opinion, the alternative to the mainstream media. And they have sold that. There's always a big market now for criticisms of the government, usually from the people who didn't elect the current president. And so I think they're going to be running this playbook against us for a very long time.
Josephine?
There's definitely a lot of mistrust. I think there was a lot before this election and perhaps even more now in terms of whether we believe that we're seeing the whole truth during elections, whether we believe we're seeing the whole truth about our candidates. I would say on the bright side, because perhaps Dave needs some cheering up, that one of the things I don't think has come out of this election and that potentially could have is a deep distrust in the voting technology itself, in the actual vote tallies, except among a small group of people. I think for the most part, people have been willing to accept the votes that were counted as they were counted and recognize that this is a legitimate outcome.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's because it wasn't close. I do think, I mean, we certainly saw all the criticisms of Chad's in 2000, suggestions that Diebold was going to throw the election to the Republicans in 2004. It's very easy to get there, and unfortunately, I would guess that probably 15% or 20% of the voting machines in the United States can be hacked, and we really probably should move to a system. And this, I hate to say this, but we need less digitization there. We've been too bedazzled by enthusiasm for new technology. We would be better off with those systems where you fill in the bubble, and the only machine in sight just does an optical read of what is on your what bubble you filled and counts it. Anything more sophisticated than that is going to end up costing us trust.
Interesting. You agree, Josephine?
Yeah, I think you can't beat paper for security. And I would go further. I would say 100% of the voting machines in the United States can be hacked. I think we're lucky that they haven't been so far, and that the trust in that technology and the actual election results still seems to be pretty stable.
Okay. Well, you know, Dave's premise, and he didn't state this outright, but he's talking about a dark scenario indeed, which is that the Russian hacking, and again, in this election, I don't think our panelists are saying they swung the election, but they certainly meddled, and Russian meddling has injured trust in the election. But let's put on even darker hats than Dave at the emailer. I want to ask both of our panelists, when you look at a worst-case scenario in terms of our current vulnerability, what does it look like? I'll start with you, Stuart.
So starting with the elections and the doxing of candidates. The next thing the Russians are going to do, I am quite convinced of it, is they're going to have clever, plausible forgeries mixed in among the genuine documents. They did a little bit of that, actually, in the documents that they released, trying to implicate George Soros' organization in some activities in Russia. And they're going to do more of that. And it'll be very hard to know what is true and what is not. Other kinds of, I think the Internet of Things that we're all about to embrace so enthusiastically is another word for computers that affect the real world, that run pipelines and electric grids and the pacemakers and defibrillators that are implanted in our chests. I have a client who just demonstrated that you could hack a St. Jude defibrillator and kill somebody because the security was so bad, because they never thought anyone would look. But the Russians will look, and the Russians will use those tactics.
Mm. Josephine?
Certainly, I think the Internet of Things presents a whole host of new and more serious threats, where you're talking about cars, you're talking about medical devices, you're talking about things that, if they malfunction, can actually kill people. I think the other thing I would touch on that, to me, is a little bit of a worst-case scenario, and we've been dancing around it perhaps in the aftermath of this election, is blackmail. Right? I don't love having high-profile politicians' email correspondence posted up online and being written about in newspapers. I think I would rather have it there on WikiLeaks for all to read than being used covertly to try and get them to do things that foreign governments or other agents want them to do behind the scenes.
Yeah, interesting. Should we be concerned about energy, grids, et cetera?
Yes, you can never say no to that question. I think one always worries about the electric grid. I would say from my perspective, in the United States, at least from what I know of the electric grid, it's fairly decentralized. It would be hard to take out power for the entire country or even half of the country at once. It would require, just because it's a fairly sort of old legacy technology and fairly old legacy systems at this point, it would be possible to compromise some of these systems. It would probably not be easy to do a very large-scale takedown.
And I confess, I haven't read Ted Koppel's book. That's on my list. It has me. I guess I should get around to seeing what he has to say about it. But Stuart, any concern about energy?
Yeah. Well, the Russians have already demonstrated that they have the capability and the will to do that. They just didn't do it to us. They did it to the Ukraine. They caused a power outage. They actually took over the computers of the people who were running the grid and shut down and caused failures in a bunch of the substations. The thing that saved the Ukrainians is their system was so old, they still had people who did manual resets in the substations, and they basically got all these old retired guys out of bed and sent them down to manually reset all of the damage that the Russians had done using computer networks. We probably couldn't do that.
Votes for paper ballots and praise for old energy systems this hour is not where I thought we were going. But, you know, Stuart, before I let you go, then about a minute left here. We're going to see you on Sunday. Some final thoughts from you on what you think that we at least anything that gives you optimism that we're going to do better when it comes to our cybersecurity.
Yes, I think we are much better at finding the people who are attacking us and identifying them. And that's going to be, we just need to get better at finding things that will deter them once we've identified them. That's how society really works. We don't count on locks. We count on locks to slow people down so the police can come and arrest them. And we need to bring that spirit to our networks. And we're getting there, at least as far as attribution is concerned.
Okay, Josephine, we're trying to end on a note of optimism. So there's Stuart's. What's yours?
Well, going back to what you just said about hailing paper ballots and old energy systems, I think one of the good things as we move towards more connected devices and Internet of Things style products is that a lot of our critical infrastructure in this country is still pretty old, is still pretty slow to be updated and changed. If you look at hospitals, if you look at the power sector, if you look at voting, a lot of us still vote on paper. And I think that's a positive thing. I think that there's some understanding that there are some critical sectors which we should perhaps not be just shifting online wholesale, and that that will probably serve us well moving forward.
I'll look for more of your work in Slate, and thank you for taking the time and sharing your expertise with us this hour. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josephine Wolf, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at RIT and faculty affiliate of RIT's Department of Computing Security, and Stuart Baker, who is the former First Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and former General Counsel of the NSA. We'll see you on Sunday in Canandaigua at FLCC. Thank you very much, Stuart.
All right, thank you.
Stuart is going to be there, and you can get tickets for that 4 p.m. event as part of the Ewing Forum at FLCC. Jump online and do that there. Tickets are $25, and you can get them now at gmeforum.org. Short break, and more Connections is next.